All right. Good evening. So nice to see you all again after you all ditched me for the summer and took a long summer break, telling me you all had things to do, but I sat around doing nothing. Okay, just kidding. It is wonderful to be back. As I mentioned, we had Baruch Hashem an excellent summer program, but I'm glad that the last kid got off the last bus. I'm able to exhale and now get back into my year-round focus. I'm very excited for the opportunity to learn with you again. And as I put in the email, I'd like to focus these 2 weeks, obviously, for the upcoming Rosh Hashanah that's coming very quickly. And then we'll talk about after Sukkot, we'll talk about what we're going to tackle next. But for tonight, I want to do something that I haven't really done with you in quite a while. And that is, I want to learn a piece of Talmud with you, a very, very intriguing piece of Talmud that I think will give us an opportunity to have a greater insight into Rosh Hashanah this year. I'm going to read from you from the tractate of Rosh Hashanah, obviously. And the Mishnah tells us that at four different times of the year, during the year, the world is judged. The world is judged at four different times. On Pesach for grain, how much grain is going to grow, how it's going to work for our livelihood. On Shavuos for the fruits of the tree. On Rosh Hashanah, let's pay attention to this one. On Rosh Hashanah, all who come to the world, meaning all people, pass before him like, and here's the word, two words, b'nei Maron. I'm not going to translate. B'nei Maron, people of something, children of something. I'm not going to translate yet. But on Rosh Hashanah, everybody comes before Hashem like B'nei Maron, as it stated, who fashions their hearts together, who understands all their deeds. And on the fourth time of the year, on the holiday of Sukkot, we are all judged for the amount of water we will have. So Pesach is for the grain, Shavuot is for the fruits, Sukkot is for water, and on Rosh Hashanah, people come before God and are judged like B'nai Maron. So if you think you're perplexed, you're in good company. The Talmud, just a few pages later, when it discusses that line of the Mishnah, reads as follows. The Gemara inquires, what is the meaning of like B'nai Maron? Right? It's a fair question. The Gemara presents three answers, three possible understandings of these words, B'nai Maron. Here in Babylonia, they translate it as like sheep. Maron is sheep. It's an Aramaic, it's similar to an Aramaic word meaning lamb, sheep. That's what it is. We'll explain this shortly, but answer number one, sheep. Reish Lakish, who was from Israel, from Eretz Yisrael, said, no, it means like the people traversing the elevated paths in the Maron area. It's a geographic area. Many hold that this perhaps is the area we now know as Meron. Meron is famously now, it's a mountain in Israel. I believe it's the second tallest mountain. Just under elevation wise from the highest mountain of Hermon. This one is Meron. Does the name Meron sound familiar to anybody? Anything famous up on that mountain? The answer is yes, but the question is, do you know what it is? I'll give you a hint. There's somebody buried there who thousands, tens of thousands of people
Where was it?
go and they flock there specifically around Lag BaOmer time.
It's your mouse, Rabbi somebody.
Randy, I'm gonna mute you, sorry. Right. Right? So who's buried there? They visit on Lag BaOmer.
Rabbi.
Yes, it does start with Rabbi. That's a very good guess. It's very like
Akiva?
his first name.
I think George went there. I think we
I'm
went
sure we
there.
did.
Yes. Yeah. It's outside of spot, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Rabbi Shimon Bar
Akiva?
Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who most people are of the opinion that he is the author of the Zohar. He's the author of many, many, many of the mystical works. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is buried. His tomb is in Meron, and people flock there. So according to the second opinion here in the Talmud, that we all come before Hashem like those that are traversing up this narrow path going up to Meron. That's answer number two. And the third answer, Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Kachayolos shel Beit David, like the soldiers of the house of David, like soldiers. So you have sheep, the thin ledge elevating up towards Meron, and the third is like soldiers. These are the three answers that are proposed. And the Gemara comments and with one more line and says, but besides for that understanding, you should also know they are all examined at one time. With one glance, God judges everybody. So it's a very difficult Talmud to understand on the surface. And my goal tonight is for us to try to delve into this a little bit better. So let's, and obviously we'll learn lessons from this. So let's start with the first one. We pass before Hashem like sheep. So what does that mean? Rashi tells us a beautiful insight. There is a mitzvah in the Torah, what we now call ma'aser. You know, I talk about this every now and then in terms of taking a tithe of the money that we earn and putting it aside and giving it to charitable, right? For needy people, for charity, whatever it is. It's called ma'aser, from the word eser. The number eser is how much? I'll give you a hint.
1/10.
Very good. The number eser is 10. So ma'aser means from 10, meaning 1/10. That's where the concept of a tithe, a tenth. That's where the term comes from. So there's a mitzvah that this applies not only to your money, not only to the wheat that you grow in the agriculture, it also applies to your animals. Every tenth sheep is marked and then offered, given in, we bring it up to the Beit HaMikdash and we deal with it. It's every tenth one. Well, how do you know which is the tenth one? Well, you take the entire pen, the entire corral, whatever you call it, right? And you have them pass through a very narrow gate that only allows them to go one at a time. And you, as they pass through, you count 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 9. Number 10 is then designated as maser, put it off to the side, and we deal with it next. 11, 12, and again, every 10th one is marked. That's called maser behema. Behema is an animal. This is a 10th of the animals. Okay? Says Rashi, the understanding of this Talmud, that we come before God and we are judged, kibnei maron, meaning like sheep that pass before one at a time. We are judged individually on Rosh Hashanah, meaning to say that God pulls up the rap sheet and says, okay, let's take a look. Oh, Tachman, let's see what we got. Not as good as I thought, right? So we stand and come and get judged before God like sheep passing through the gate, passing through the door one at a time. We'll come back to this. Second, the second understanding is like these mountain climbers going up to Meron, where on a narrow ledge, you cannot stand side by side. You can only traverse it single file, right? Like you go up and I once did a hike with my wife that at this point, now that I know what it is, I probably won't do it again. It was quite challenging. And there were various parts of the hike that literally, I'm not exaggerating, the ledge on which we had to stand with our chest up against the mountain, the ledge we walked on, we had to walk like this you know, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot, just along the ledge. The ledge could not have been more than 14, 15 inches. I mean, you're not talking major. It was terrifying. But if you could not stand next to each other, it was single file. Similarly, answer number two in this piece of Talmud is that when we come before Hashem on Rosh Hashanah, we are like these mountain climbers on a narrow ledge that, again, can't be with anyone else. You stand individually, stand singularly. And then we get to the third one, like soldiers. When soldiers are marching in single file, as you stand before the king, you come in one at a time, single file. They all three answers seem to have a similar theme or a similar context, that the message being conveyed is that when we stand before Hashem on Rosh Hashanah and we are being judged for how our year went, we are being judged singularly as individuals. That's what all three. And the last comment of the Talmud says, but don't forget, we also are judged collectively, which seems to contradict. Like, how do you do be individual and collective at the same time? These are the points that I wish to discuss tonight. And I think if we delve into it and try to examine why the three answers seem to say the same thing, but in different ways, what is it that they're trying to convey? So let's start with the sheep. Let's start with the first answer. Again, the Mishnah states that we come on Rosh Hashanah and we are judged like those that pass. We stand before God and pass before him as, answer number one, as sheep, as individuals based on our personal and unique qualities, our abilities, our talents. I don't know about you, but most of us, I'll speak for myself, I think I am no different than everybody else. Human nature is as for me as it is for you. And that is, we love to compare ourselves relative to someone else. It's so easy to make ourselves feel better when we find someone who is not as good as us, who doesn't do what we do. Or if it's in the negative, oh, I only do that occasionally. He, well, you know, that is very much human nature, of we try to make it relative to someone else. I'm generally a good person, right? Pick whatever example it is, whether it's in terms of our Judaism or just life in general. I work hard in my job. So-and-so, I mean, that's a slacker. Even though they put in 8 hours, I put in 9. And I'm looking and I'm like, I put in the extra. It's just easy to look at that way. Comes along answer number one and says, God does not do that. When we get judged on Rosh Hashanah, we do not have the luxury of saying, yeah, but look at him. Look at her. Compared to her, I'm like, I should go to the front of the line of the righteous 101. If you're really going to look at it that, God doesn't do that. It's not in comparison to others. And the truth is, I think we knew that intuitively. As much as we try to fool ourselves, or maybe fool is too strong of a word, we sometimes allow ourselves to look at it that way. We know deep down that's not how it works, because you can't compare yourself to someone else. Your abilities are not her abilities, and his abilities are not like the other guy's abilities. You can't expect the same thing from two people. It's not a fair comparison. I love to teach this idea, because let's ask a very simple question. If I was to ask you, who was the greater leader, Moshe or his brother Aaron? Moses or Aaron? Who was the better leader? What would you say?
Aaron.
Exactly my point, right? One of you is going to say Moses. One of you is going to say Aaron, right? And we could spend the whole class and each one of you can defend your thesis as to why you feel the way you do. But what you've done is you've set up a hierarchy. One is better than the other. comes along the Torah, and in a matter of two verses in the book of Shemot, in the book of Exodus, when it discusses who the leadership of the Jewish people are that came before Pharaoh to bring about the Exodus, one verse has it as Moshe followed by Aaron, and the very next verse has Aaron followed by Moshe. And Rashi is bothered by that. Rashi, quoting our early sages, says, why in one place it's Moses before and in the other place Aaron is before? Says Rashi, an amazing thing. To teach us shekulam shavim, that they were equals. You're not going to put one in front of the other. I mean, you have to because, you know, you can't fit two names in the same spot. So you're going to have to put one first. So the way the Torah teaches us that there were equals is in one spot puts one first, and in the other spot, they put the other one first. So you can't infer and say, oh, must be this one is, right? That's how Rashi, again, quoting the early sources, tells us that they were equal. However, it's impossible to say such a thing. It's impossible. One of the 13 cardinal principles, the 13 fundamentals of belief of our religion, is that there was never and never will be a prophet as great as Moses. That is belief 101. You cannot. If you think that Ezekiel, and with the greatest insights and the greatest vision about God's throne and all that he talks about, is on the same level as Moshe, you are considered a heretic. Jeremiah, you name the prophet, they're unbelievable. You and I will probably never get to that level. But to equate them with Moshe would be heresy. So how could Rashi tell us that Moshe and Aaron were equal? Moshe was a greater prophet than Aaron ever would be, and then ever was. You can't call them equals. You hear my question?
Maybe they were equal in maximizing their particular talents, but Moses had more, so he was able to do more. But Aaron did the best he could with what he had.
Okay. So listen to what, Michelle, you're saying. You're telling me that it is the way God judges it is you do not compare A and B. They can never be compared to each other because one is given these amount of talents. This one was given these talents, and each one has their job is to fulfill and maximize that potential that was within them. And if they each maximize, even though one, if you're looking at the same ladder, one is truly higher than the other, it's an irrelevant point because you maxed out the best you can be and he maxed out the best he can be. That's called equal. That's what you're suggesting. You'd be right. That is how some of the commentaries explain this. If you think about it, this calls into question, can we, the generation that's living right now in 2025, in the Hebrew year Tufshin Pei He, 5785, God willing, soon to be 5786. Can we be the ones to bring Mashiach? Really? There were greater generations way before us. Almost every generation before us. We're the ones who could potentially bring Mashiach? If Avram and Sarah couldn't bring it, and Moshe Aaron and Miriam couldn't bring it, and Rabbi Akiva couldn't bring it, and Hillel couldn't bring it, and the Baal Shem Tov couldn't bring it, and the Arizal couldn't bring it, and Rav Shimon Bar Yochai couldn't bring it, and I can go on and on and on and on and on, and what? Shmagegis like us can bring it? How can that be? The answer is because, like Michelle, you said, maybe their deck of cards had 52 cards in their deck. We're deficient. We're so far down on the chain. We're only given. We don't have those abilities anymore. And certainly not of that capability. Maybe we're only given 42 cards in our deck. But if we maximize our 42, it's not comparison to their 52. We have the ability to maximize ourselves. And this is how the Rambam, Maimonides, actually writes. He says, Kol Adam Roi Leo Lelios Tzadik, every person, it is fitting and proper for him to be as righteous Kimoshe Rabbeinu, like Moshe himself, O Rasha Ki Yeravam, or to be as wicked as King Jeroboam, King Yeravam, who is one of the absolute worst. Every person is invested. You can be the greatest tzaddik, the greatest righteous individual, or you can fall down to the lowest levels of depravity. How can it be? As great as Moshe, I can't be Moshe. Nor me, nor am I being asked to be Moshe. After 120 years, ladies and gentlemen, we are never going to be asked by God, how come we weren't Moshe? That's not the question we're going to be asked. We're going to be asked a personal question. Why weren't you the best Tzvi Tachman? That's for me. You're not going to get that question either, right? Each one of us is going to get that question. How come you weren't you? What are you going to answer? Oh, I couldn't? Well, God knows what potentially placed within each one of us. But it's personal. It's what it is understanding, yeah, I can't reach the actual level of Moshe or Aaron or Rabbi Akiva and all the greats that I just mentioned. They were given talents well above mine, well above ours. But we are asked to reach our level. And that's why Moshe and Aaron are equal. Moshe maximized his potential. Aaron maximized his potential. That's how it works. And therefore, when we come before Hashem, the first answer tells us that we have to come before God as sheep, individuals, with our abilities and our talents. This is one understanding about this first answer of what it means to stand before Hashem like sheep. But I think there's a second one, and it's a little different, but I think it deserves. When I say that we stand before Hashem like sheep, What came to your mind?
Sheep to slaughter.
Okay, sheep to slaughter. Okay, using that expression, what I'm sure Muriel means is that the classic animal, the sheep, is a complete follower. No sense of leadership. It just does what it's led to do. Being led like sheep to slaughter. Do they not see the sheep in front of them that they go in and they're not coming out? Like something should dawn on them and say, hey, maybe this isn't the best room for me. They wouldn't do very well in doing all these new escape rooms. They wouldn't know how to get out. It's just walking in. So here perhaps is an additional insight. Maybe we have to come before Hashem and we have to answer the question, did we just follow along with society like sheep? Did we take the time to think, is this really right? Is this really a value that I hold dear? Is this in line with my morals? Or just, that's what everybody thinks, right? You remember Dr. Ash's experiments? Dr. Ash, he did the experiments about, everybody was told ahead of time about two lines, you all know this. It was in the 60s, I think. They did an experiment of where he had everybody in the class, except for one person, he told ahead of time that when I put on the board three lines, they look different and they were different sizes, right? But I want everyone to say that B and C, which were clearly not the same size, is the same size. And this one person who didn't know about this test, wasn't told, they're looking around like, no, C is much larger than B. And yet going around them, no, B and C are equal. And they doubted themselves so much that they gave the wrong answer. They gave the answer because everybody else was saying that. Does this not sound familiar?
No.
Oh my gosh. It was an unbelievable, it was groundbreaking work on peer pressure and understanding this. We go through life and we're given opportunities every day to either follow or question whether to follow. but we get swept up sometimes, and just follow along like sheep. Now, sometimes that's a good thing. If you surround yourself with really great people, okay. You know, if you happen to fall into the crowd that loves to go to shul, and it wasn't your top priority, but you know what? Okay, you got schlepped along. You follow them to shul. Okay, I can think of worse things. So there are positives to being a follower in some regard. But it's very dangerous if you just go along and never take the time to think independently. We have to stand before Hashem on Rosh Hashanah like sheep. We have to be able to answer the question, did I do what I did because I was just going along with the crowd, or I made a conscious decision for that, whether it's positive or negative? But I can't just go. I can't just be a sheep and just do everything blindly the way it goes. If I didn't think for myself, if it was moral, if it was correct, I'm obligated to do that. So the first answer that the Talmud tells us is that we stand before Hashem and we come before him like sheep. I'm explaining it in two ways. One, like sheep in the sense of individual, like going through the gate when you're counting out the 10th one to give to Maser, individually, that you have to be able to say, my abilities, I can't compare myself to others. Or the second understanding of the sheep, and that is, was I just a follower, or did I give thought to the actions that I did or the beliefs that I held? Two understandings on that part. Let's keep going. The second answer is that it was like mountain climbers that were going up to the area of Meron, and it's a very narrow ledge. What is this, perhaps a deeper meaning here? If you ever done a hike, or you've ever done something that's a little bit more challenging, you have to, let me put it this way. You can have two people. Here's a good example. A kid, a Shoresh kid, who never really heard of the concept of making a bracha on food. Never heard of it. Maybe was aware, but didn't know, but it didn't. And somebody who grew up with that since he's a little boy. And they both make a hamotzi lechem min haaretz when they sit down to eat their bread. Each one, if you look at it just on the surface, they both did exactly the same thing. A ate bread and made hamotzi, B ate bread and made hamotzi. However, you have to look at the context in which this takes place. Circumstance for guy number one is that he grew up with it. So he knew about this since he's a little kid. I'm not saying it's not a good thing, but it's not the same in the context of the kid who never made hamotzi, learned about it, and forgets and is trying his best to try to do it. The context in which the mitzvah is done plays a very pivotal role. Perhaps this is the deeper meaning of a mountain climber, someone who's pushing himself to go a little bit out of their comfort zone. I'm going to make it up this hike. I'm going to walk. I'm going to exercise. I'm not just going to go with the regular routine. The context is taken into account. How hard was the challenge based on background, education, past experiences, circumstances? You have to be able to take that into consideration. When we stand before Hashem, he takes that all in. I think about many of the people, some of you included, where you didn't go necessarily to a Jewish day school. You didn't necessarily get a formal Jewish education. Maybe you went to a Hebrew school. Maybe you went even further, whatever it was. But it's not the same. So you're coming to a class is, I think, in God's eyes, much more valuable than the guy who went to yeshiva and he knows, how do you waste the whole night? I'm going to sit and learn for an hour. I'm not taking anything away from the yeshiva guys. I'm saying what your context is a much more difficult. You've climbed a mountain. The yeshiva guy, he's walking on flat ground. He's already gained that territory. You're climbing mountains. Hashem takes that into consideration. But the difficult part maybe along the same lines, is how hard do we push ourselves to constantly climb the mountain? Did we plateau? Did we reach a level of where, okay, I'm satisfied. I did. I grew. I'm not poo-pooing, but okay. I'm complacent from here on out. I'm going to ride it out. Did we attempt to climb new heights? Did we attempt to perhaps, I don't know, expand our comfort zone to grow a little bit more? Maybe improve our observance a little in some way, fashion or form, right? Whether it's helping other people. This is a biggie. I've shared this with many people. They think I'm the teacher and they're the students, and that's the role that we always play. And it's not true. It's not true. Besides the fact that I learn from all of you and I am a student, the truth of the matter is that every one of us is a teacher. Because if we know something, we have the ability to share that with someone else. Doesn't mean you're the expert in the field, but it means you have knowledge and that you could help someone understand it. You can help someone have a greater appreciation for it. That's, everyone has that ability. Were we willing to risk, be a little bit more daring, climb the mountain for a little bit more Torah, for a little bit more for a mitzvah? If you're not sure, if you're, yeah, I do, but I don't, here's your litmus test. Do you feel the same the same drive or lack of a drive to expand when it comes to pursuing greater materialistic things? How many of us were okay just financially getting by? Did we push ourselves a little bit harder, push ourselves out of a comfort zone and say, I got to do this. I got to make sure that, I'm at this level, but I really got to push to do this level. I got to be able to do a little bit more, you know, traveling. There are people who push themselves to travel to on a maybe I can get a business deal. Okay. How about us traveling to the synagogue? Maybe I can learn something in a new class. The rabbi's offering a new class. Maybe I can push myself. I don't normally stay for, I don't know, whatever it is, the whole Musaf service. Maybe I need to push myself a little bit further and pursue that. Are we going to be good mountain climbers? We have to be able to answer that question. Because if we do it in some areas of our life, then what's the excuse why we don't do it for our spiritual life? And this is a question we have to answer on Rosh Hashanah. So, again, mountain climbers have the advantage that the context, when we stand before Hashem, he takes our circumstances into consideration, the challenges in our life, things that people may not even be aware of, but God is aware of, how hard it is, takes that into consideration. But are we being a little too complacent and God is really asking us to be a little bit more of a mountain climber? Second aspect. Then we come to the third one. The soldier. Soldiers. Well, this one is I find very interesting. To really appreciate this one, we got to take a little bit of a detour. How do we know that we get judged on Rosh Hashanah? I know I read you the Mishnah. I know that that's, you know, a source, but there seems to be another source. It's a fascinating source. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with Pharaoh and the interpretation of the dreams that Yosef had for the wine steward and the baker. It's really fascinating. Listen to the story. Here we go. The chamberlain of the cupbearer, the wine steward, and the baker have their dreams. Long story short, you all know this. They each had a dream on the same night, each one according to the interpretation of his dream, each one. And Yosef interprets them to the wine steward. He said, you're going to get reinstated back to your post. And to the baker, he said, you're going to get hanged. But listen to the wording here. I'm going to read you how the Torah presents it. Joseph came to them in the morning. He saw them, and behold, they were aggrieved. He asked Pharaoh's courtiers who were with him in the ward of his master's house, saying, why do you appear downcast today? Why do you guys look so down? What are you so depressed about? They said to him, we dreamt a dream, but there is no interpreter for it. So Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Relate it to me, if you please. Tell me what you dreamt. Then the chamberlain of the cupbearers recounted his dream to Joseph and said to him, listen to the dream, right? Listen carefully. In my dream, behold, there was a grapevine in front of me. On the grapevine were three tendrils, and it was as though it budded. Its blossoms bloomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm. Joseph said to him, this is its interpretation. The three tendrils are 3 days, and in another 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and will restore you to your post, and you will place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as was the former practice when you were his cupbearer. If only you would think of me with yourself, and he asked him to remember when he goes back there. Okay, chamberlain of the baker saw that he interpreted well, so he said to Joseph, I too, in my dream, behold, three wicker baskets were on my head, and in the uppermost basket were all kinds of Pharaoh's food, baker's handiwork, and the birds were eating them from the basket above my head. Joseph responded, this is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days, and 3 days Pharaoh will lift your head from you and hang you on a tree. Birds will eat your flesh from you. And that's exactly what happened. It was on the third day, Pharaoh's birthday. Make a little mental note. Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he counted the chamberlain of the cupbearers and the chamberlain of the bakers among his servants. He restored the chamberlain of cupbearers to his cupbearing, and he placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm, but the chamberlain of the bakers he hanged, just as Joseph had interpreted to them, and we move on. How did Joseph know that the guy, the wine steward, is going to get restored to his post? And the guy, the baker, is going to get hanged. And question number one, well, let's leave it at that. How did he know? Is there anything in the dreams itself that lends itself for you that would indicate how he knew that one was going to get restored and one was going to get killed? Is there anything that struck you about what they each said?
The grapevines were blossoming and blooming. And then on the other one, the birds were eating it up.
Okay, good. Excellent. Anything else? Any other phrases that caught you?
The wine guy, he squeezed the grapes. He did something with them to make the wine for the Pharaoh. The other guy was just carrying the stuff on his head. But he didn't shoo away the birds. He let him eat it.
Okay.
You know, he good didn't. Points.
These are all good points. Anyone, any last one? And then I'm going to put the emphasis on different syllables so you can you can pick up on the key points that I think are really, it changes the whole context of the story. I'll start backwards. Let's talk about the fact that Pharaoh, when he gives back the post to the wine guy, as you call him, listen to what it says. Remember, the Torah is narrating the story of what happened. What's the most critical piece of that part of the story?
That he's restored to his position.
That's it. Marcia hit it on the head. He's restored back to his position. Listen to how the Torah recounts it. It was on the third day, Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all the servants, and he counted. Da, 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 da. He restored the chamberlain of the cupbearers to his cup bearing, and he placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm. But the chamberlain of the bakers, he hanged just as Joseph. Okay, he restored it to his post. What else do I think he would have done if not give Pharaoh his next cup of wine? That's his job. Why is the Torah telling me he restored him to his post and he put it in Pharaoh's palm? Before you answer that, let's go back to the dream. Watch how the wine guy presents his dream. In my dream, behold, there was a grapevine in front of me. Think like a wine guy and tell me which part is relevant and which part is not. Behold, there was a grapevine in front of me. On the grapevine were three tendrils, and it was as though it budded. Its blossoms bloomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. Okay. And I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I placed the cup on Pharaoh's palm. What are you hearing? What is he stressing over and over and over again?
That everything he did was for Pharaoh.
Bingo. This is not about me. This is all my job of taking care of Pharaoh. I'm at your service, sir. Again, it has all these things. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup. I didn't say I pressed it into wine. I pressed it into Pharaoh's cup and I placed the cup in Pharaoh's palm. It's all about Pharaoh. How about the next guy, the baker? He says, in my dream, behold, three wicker baskets were on my head. And in the uppermost basket were all kinds of Pharaoh's food, baker's handiwork. And the birds were eating them from the basket above my head. Who's he serving? Who's he focused on?
Him.
Him. His work. The baker's work. Nebuch, the birds were eating my bread. Not the birds were eating Pharaoh's bread. It's all about me. Joseph, here's this. Now, I'm not suggesting, obviously, this is how Hashem gave him the understanding, but you see a tremendous difference between the wine guy whose main, almost I would say singular focus is how he is going to be at the service of Pharaoh. What can I do for him? The baker, while his job was to bake for the Pharaoh, it was him. Look what I can do. Look at what I made for Pharaoh, but look at what the handiwork that in my basket, they were eating off of my head. It's not about Pharaoh. It's not about the king. Pharaoh hears the story. Pharaoh understands who's the one that's here for my service. That's the one I'm going to reinstate back to a post. The one who's in it for himself, who happens to be working for me, I don't have a place for him in my kingdom. The Midrash tells us that one of the sources for the fact that that Rosh Hashanah is a day of God judging us is from this story. Why? Because Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of the year, the birthday of the world, right? We know that if you turn the clock back 5,700 years ago, it corresponds to creation. It corresponds to the sixth day of creation when Adam and Eve were put to the test. The king is Pharaoh, but the king in the story for us is on his birthday, the day that he gets coronated as the king, which is what Rosh Hashanah is. He wants to know who's a loyal servant, who's in it for me, and who's in it for something else, perhaps even themselves. Who is my loyal servant? Who is the soldier who will do anything because he's a loyal servant to the king? Are they willing to do? Are we willing to do whatever it takes to fulfill the will of the king with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our might that we say every single day in the Shema? Or is that just lip service? Yeah. I'm on board. And meanwhile, our actions belie that. Do we, in fact, are we loyal soldiers willing to do what it takes to be at the service of God and fulfill what it is to make a world a better place, to make the world filled with a much more significant purpose than just being? I remember as a kid, I saw this cartoon from Ziggy. Remember Ziggy cartoon? Loved it. A lot of them were brilliant. My two favorites. One is not for tonight, but it's a good one. I'll tell it to you anyway, but it's not the topic of the night, of where he's standing and he's outside a bakery shop and he sees one frame after another with the most delicious pastries and beautiful, I mean, donuts and croissants and apple turnovers and you name it, Danishes. And then towards the very bottom, it says, I don't know why they talk about willpower. It really should be won't power. Beautiful observation. But the one for tonight is where Ziggy comments and says that he wants to know when we can just take a break and just be human beings instead of human doings. And I disagree vehemently, vehemently with that concept. We are never just human beings. We don't just be, we do. Because if we stop doing and we just be, we don't belong here anymore. If we're here, we're here to do. We're here to accomplish. So Hashem wants to know on Rosh Hashanah, it's a new year. It's the birthday of the world. It's like King Pharaoh's birthday. We're going to make a feast. Who are my loyal soldiers who want to be a part of next year's service? And who's, you know, well, in it for other reasons? Are we willing to do it? Tell you a great story. What time is it? We're good. I think I read this to you once upon a time. I can never remember. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I think we've been doing our class. I want to say it's 16, maybe 17 years we've been doing. We've been learning together at Beth Shalom with our group. And that's just me. You have years before me. But listen to this story. It talks about Frederick the Great, the king of Prussia during the late 1700s. He was reviewing his troops when he noticed a middle-aged soldier wearing an interesting ornament. Dangling from what appeared to be an heirloom watch chain was the spent casing of a bullet. It had been polished and shined as it replaced a watch that the soldier obviously was unable to afford. The king, being in a playful mood, pulled his diamond-studded pocket watch from his vest and held it in the sunlight. As the rays glinted off the diamonds that surrounded its face, he stared at his piece intently. Then he looked at the soldier. My dear soldier, he said in mock concern as he tugged on the exquisite piece attached to its chain. My timepiece says that it is 1:30. What time does yours tell? Soldier looked down at the bullet. Your honor, he declared with sincere humility, the ornament that dangles from my watch chain does not tell me the time. Rather, it is a bullet. A bullet, scoffed Frederick the Great. Why on earth would you wear a bullet instead of a watch? To me, your honor, there are no hours, minutes, or seconds. My watch tells me that every moment I'm willing to take a bullet, even if it means my life, for your majesty. The king was so impressed with the soldier's reply that he promptly removed his exquisite royal watch and presented it to the soldier. Mortals, listen to this line. Mortals look for accolades that personify their own wisdom, wealth, and accomplishments. The Torah looks for accolades to identify the accomplishment of man's reason for being. Moshe, when he died, well, you know what the greatest compliment the Torah gives? How great Moshe was? Two words. Two simple words that encompass the greatness of Moshe. Eved Hashem, a loyal servant to God. That is the greatest praise. Can you imagine after 120 years, person passes from this world, God greets them up there and says, make way for my most loyal soldier, for the person that said, I live my life in service to God. I lived it honestly when I was in business. I lived it fairly when I dealt with colleagues. I dealt, you know, in all the ways that morally in my marriage, you name it. There's nobody that is more loyal. That's what Hashem is looking for. So on Rosh Hashanah, when we stand before him and we come before him, Kibnei Maron, which the third answer was like a soldier, you know what God is looking for? He's looking for our commitment to be at his service another year. Are we committed to that? That means staying alert, being prepared at all times to defend the honor of Torah, to defend the honor of Hashem, the Jewish people, as opposed to what is now so in vogue is the apathy, the indifference. Yeah, whatever. No, there's no whatevers. That's a teenage thing. We all got out of that phase. Should have gotten out of that phase. This is, you know, do we take our mission seriously like a loyal soldier? These are the three answers that are given. And each one of them, I think, gives us the insight, whether it's like the sheep as individuals with our talents, or like the mountain climber that has to push ourselves to expand and to take on the next hike to do it, or like soldiers that are loyal servants to Hashem. This is what's being asked of us. However, to finish it all up, we're left with that one question at the very beginning. The last line of the Talmud seems to suggest that we're also being judged as collective, as one unit. Well, is it individuals or is it collective? Is it relative to the next guy? You know, because I'd love to pick a few people to hang around with so that I look good, you know. But what does it mean that we're all collective? What do you think? I'll throw it out there to you first, and then I'll see if we can, you know, it's like match game. See if we can match.
That the community is working together and doing what they should according to the Torah.
Good, but how does that help for me?
Because you're part of the community.
But I'm being judged individually.
Does it have something to do with we have a responsibility to other people? It's not just us that we have to be concerned with and what we're doing or how we're doing, but part of it is to take into consideration other people and, you know, like you are your brother's keeper.
Okay. So you and Marcia, I mean, you're along the same lines, and I think you're really correct. And that is, we don't live our lives only as individuals. Yes, I am being judged. There's two elements of the judgment here on Rosh Hashanah. One is vis-a-vis myself. I have nobody else. I have to be able to stand before Hashem and just, you know, face the music for how I lived my life as it pertains to me. But that's not my whole, that's not my only part. Because like you said, Marsha, I'm also part of a community. And my playing a role in that community, as you said, Michelle, my role in, am I doing things to advance the betterment of the community? That's not only for me individually. It takes into account everybody. So there really are two aspects of the judgment on Rosh Hashanah. One is that we have to line up before him as an individual. Based on the talents that God gave me, I have to live up to that. I can't just say, well, I'm better than him. That's not going to fly. Because if I were given more abilities, more talents, then I have a greater responsibility. But there's another aspect, and that is my role within the larger group, within the larger context of the community, and my role there. I had a teacher once who explained this a little bit further, and it gave me a little bit of a little inspiration, and perhaps it played a very pivotal role in why I chose to do what I do. And that is, most of us, again, I'll speak for myself, I think many of us, if not most of us, would be terrified to have to just stand before God as an individual, just based on my merits and demerits. It's a scary proposition because we know, if we're honest with ourselves, we know we fall short. However, being that I'm also judged on my role in the community, that means to say that even if I am failing to some degree on my individual level, but I'm given some level of leniency because the community needs me and I play a role in the community. So yes, I'm obligated to push myself individually to improve, to better myself and to develop, you know, character traits that is for my own benefit. But the silver lining is that if I am a communal person, I do take my synagogue seriously. I get involved with that and I stay involved and I'm helpful to try to get others involved. And I play a role in the larger Jewish community. Then there's a little leniency because God says, while you may be falling short in the individual aspect, it's good to know that there's a second aspect and you play a very pivotal role. The community needs you. That's a loyal service. You're a loyal soldier in that regard. So the two seem to be contradictory, but they're really complementary. They're two parts of who we are, individuals, but part of the community as well. And that is perhaps why the Mishnah doesn't just say like the other three times we're judged, on Pesach for this and on Sukkot for this. This, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, I can't just say we're judged. The Mishnah can't just say that because there's so much depth to understand what it is I'm being judged for. Because the complexity of a human being can't be whittled down to a one-liner that says you're judged on Rosh Hashanah. You're more than that. You're complex, that you have individual aspects, you have communal aspects, and how those interplay with each, that's all taken into consideration as sheep, as mountain climbers, and as soldiers. Robin, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was a comment, I think. So when you were talking about the community, I was also thinking like how you were saying, we're driving home, sorry. I'm not driving. That, you know, Jews have to be examples for others. And so I was taking that as like, you know, as part of a community, you have to uphold that standard that other people, like you're light unto other nations.
Yeah, no question about it.
And that's how you're judged as a community. That's what I was thinking.
To be a part of that. That is the mission. That's the raison d'etre of the Jewish people. That's what we're here to do. That is our mission.
But I was taking that the judgment of the community. Were you upholding that standard in the community? Being that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
I'm with you. Any other thoughts, comments, questions? Well, you're an easy group. Usually I get bombarded. It's like, what? How could you say something like that, Rabbi? It's a good thing it's before Rosh Hashanah. We'll go easy on you.
The sheep reminded me of certain mattresses.
Okay. Right. So the answer is, right, Hashem judges us like sheep. Are you sleeping well?
No comment.
Is everybody judged, Rabbi? Everybody, everything, all creatures?
People.
All people?
Well, by definition, well, let's put it this way. You can only judge something that has choices to make. You're not going to evaluate a robot. There's no judging a robot. It just does what it does. So the only creatures that are invested with free choice are human beings.
And does God judge the whole world, everyone, even though they don't observe Rosh Hashanah, even though they're not Jewish?
Well, again, it's taken into context, meaning if you're talking about, let's say, a non-Jew, right? So they don't even know what it is they're supposed to do.
Right.
Okay. So again, given the context, they have certain responsibilities. Every human being, Jew and Gentile alike, has responsibilities to live a certain moral life. That's a given. And it doesn't matter what country you're from, what religion you practice, there is our basic standard of moral living. And the Torah does have what is known as the seven Noahide laws, that a lot of them are basic social order. That's a requirement. Are they judged on that? Yeah, I don't know if it happens on Rosh Hashanah or maybe just at the end of their life. I'm not sure about that. But clearly for us, our new year is Rosh Hashanah. It's the annual evaluation of how we're doing. That's really what it is. Because as I said before, turn the clock back 5,700 years ago, it corresponds to the sixth day of creation when the test was first put in motion. The mission was first done. Now, they failed on that original mission in the Garden of Eden, but every year, it's like when you get hired at a job, you have an annual evaluation and it's on the anniversary of your hire. That's when it is. So we were all hired as human beings. And certainly once the Torah was given, we were hired as a Jewish people to do a certain job. Our mission here is an annual evaluation, and it corresponds to Rosh Hashanah. Muriel.
Well, this may sound ridiculous.
I love it.
But in speaking about free choice and not being able to be judged unless you have a choice, I don't think you've met my cat. Because no, I am serious. My cat has a choice. Every time I call her and she looks at me and knows I'm calling her and she chooses to come or not, is that not free choice?
No, that's not free choice. Free choice is not, it's a long discussion, but free choice is not just choosing between two options. Your cat is born with a certain stubborn streak. Every cat is born with that, by the way. Yours happens to be, it excels in that regard. However, not every choice.
It's not a choice.
It's not really a choice. It's not what we're calling free choice that has a moral piece of it. Well, I'll give you the example I often choose. If you go to the ice cream store and you choose between chocolate and vanilla, did you exercise your free will?
Yes.
The answer is no.
You just made a choice.
You made a choice. I know the term free choice in its most broad sense means every decision you make, but that's not what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about free choice, I mean things that have consequence with moral, weighty issue. It doesn't have to be, weighty is too strong of a word. It has moral significance. Choosing between chocolate and vanilla, okay, so your taste buds, you have a certain, proclivity towards vanilla. Okay, your cat prefers this cat food and not that cat food. Yes, they're choosing this, but that's an inborn thing. That's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about making the cat can't make decisions of right and wrong. That's really what I mean to say. Right and wrong. It can.
I invite you to meet my cat. She can make decisions between right and wrong.
Yeah. There's preferences. Animals have preferences, 100%. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about right and wrong decisions. Can your cat, if you look at your cat and say, today is Yom Kippur, don't eat, and you put the food out, is your cat going to eat it?
Probably not, because she usually doesn't eat anything, but not because of Yom Kippur. I mean, okay. I acknowledge that is.
Yeah. But if I put a plate of food in front of you and I say, it's Yom Kippur, and you say, but I'm really hungry, and I say, it's Yom Kippur, you say, okay, I won't do it. That's a moral decision, because your belly is telling you you're hungry. Your body is telling you I should be eating. I'm getting tired. I'm getting weak. The day is getting on. Ne'ilah, oh my gosh, every year it seems like Ne'ilah gets 20 minutes longer. It just goes on, right? And it feels like Yom Kippur is like a 4-day yuntif. But I make a moral choice that this is the day I'm not going to eat. Your animal cannot do that. It can't. It doesn't have the ability to go against its nature and say no. It doesn't have the ability. Only human beings have that ability. That's what I'm referring to. Think about it. It's a great concept. Okay. Any other thoughts, questions? Okay. Fabulous. All right. So Baruch Hashem, we're back. We're going to keep at it. Next Wednesday night, again at 8 o'clock, we have the next installment of our Rosh Hashanah series. What's that one called? It's called, forgot what I called it already.
About Yom Kippur. It is.
It's also about Rosh Hashanah.
Invalidating our signature on the divine decree.
There you go. Invalidating our signatures on the divine decree. It's a very cool concept. All right.
Rabbi, did you announce what the class is going to be about yet, or we're not there yet?
For after Sukkot? No.
You didn't tell us the topic yet.
No. It's like mountain climbing. Got to keep you in suspense. It's a
Okay.
cliffhanger.
All right. Because I missed the beginning, so I wasn't sure.
No. All right. Yes, we decided, but we're not telling you.
Okay. Well, then I'll have to reach higher to figure it out. So.
Have a great rest of the week. Have a great Shabbos if I don't speak to you beforehand. See you next week.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great seeing everybody again.
Yep.
Good night.
Good night,
everybody. Good night. Good night. Good seeing everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Good night.